Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and film show. This week, the great Hugh Jackman talks to me about his new film, The Death of Robin Hood, a very different reading of Robin Hood. I also talk to the film's director, Michael Cernowski, Ray Winston, Vinnie Jones, and Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, Giancarlo Esposito. Talk to me about the new season of The Gentlemen, the Guy Ritchie, The Gentleman, season 2 on Netflix. Plus, a new, wonderfully strange Irish movie called Celtic Utopia. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well. I had a busy week of it this week. I flew to London to interview Hugh Jackman, which you'll be hearing about soon. I was also at Bon Jovi on Sunday night. I'm not really a Bon Jovi fan, no harm to them, just was never really my thing. But a friend of mine couldn't use his tickets, so me and another friend of mine went along. Very impressive gig, I have to say. Mr. Bon Jovi and the band, indeed, God, they know their stagecraft. It was relentless, hits after hits, stadium filling stuff. Well, the stadium was full, so that's an oxymoron, but it was great. It really was a well-paced show. I was very, very impressed, I have to say. And I love when bands do this, big ones. He started with A Little Help From My Friends, the Beatles song, but kind of the Joe Cocker version. What would you do? That sounded like Tom Waits, but you know what I mean. I thought it was a brilliant opener, and it was great. So hats off to Bon Jovi. I was also at the American football game, this college football game that was on in the Aviva on Saturday night, where two American football teams, TCU versus North Carolina. I brought my eldest, who was mad to go. And you know what? The spectacle, very impressive, marching bands, cheerleaders, all sorts of crack going on. I just, you know, I kind of knew it was going to be this way. It just stops too much for my liking. It's four quarters, 15 minutes. And the game took about 3 hours and 45 minutes. Now, I know there are lots of big fans of it and people get it. I just find the stops too much. The gameplay is terrific, really entertaining stuff, but it just constantly stops. Now, my 14-year-old really enjoyed it, every moment of it. So I'm clearly in the minority, and I was certainly in the minority in that stadium last Saturday night. But an enjoyable experience nonetheless, and very well-managed transport around the stadium, may I just say. So, you know, don't always praise these things, but I thought the way they were getting people onto trains was very well done. So hats off to you if you were one of the stewards at the Aviva last Saturday night, because it was a well-managed event. And look, people love American football, so what do I know? I'll tell you what I do know. It is currently, as I speak to you right now, National Cinema Weekend. This Saturday, the 5th, and indeed Sunday, the 6th of September, is National Cinema Weekend, where cinemas, and there's about 99% of them, so practically every cinema in Ireland, is offering really cheap tickets, starting at €4. Now, there will occasionally be booking fees and stuff like that, but highly reduced from €4. Cinemas all over Ireland, all the big movies are on. I know already a lot of the Odyssey ones are sold out in the IMAX. The Odeon in Blanchardstown, my understanding is it's running 24 hours this Saturday evening. Check the local cinema, or you can also visit cinemaweekend.ie. We are one of the biggest attenders of cinema in Europe. More people went to see the Odyssey per capita in Ireland in its opening week than anybody else. So continue to support the cinema, and it's going to support you this weekend if you go, because all tickets are starting at €4. So that is the cinema. But in TV this week, I was watching this.
Joel G.
Yes, Governor.
Do me a Piccolo Espresso from the Mazooka, will you? Sling it in the art room.
Leave it with me. It's in the post, boss.
Lovely. Now, I know you got your reservations about Akiko, but his boots on the ground. Now, I want you to work with him on this.
Sure thing, Dad. Mm-hmm. Nice work.
So how's the old plan going, getting the Duke into the House of Lords?
Well, once we've resolved the Jack and Lord Hawthorne sitch.
But we're confident we're going to work him through. Mm. He's definitely the right person to talk to.
Well, that's good, because I need you in there. We're killing this bill. No ifs or buts.
Yes, a clip there from The Gentleman, and you heard the great Ray Winston, you heard Theo James and Kaya Scodelario there. Three of the people from season two of The Gentleman. You may remember The Gentleman, it was 2 years ago, I think, at this stage, the Guy Ritchie caper drama, I guess you'd call it. Very entertaining stuff, where we have Theo James, who you heard there talking to Ray Winston, playing the Duke, Eddie Horniman. His father dies and he inherits a kind of creaky mansion and a title and lots of land. And in season one, he decides to team up with Susie Glass, who you heard there as well, the aforementioned Kaya Scodelario, and Ray Winston's character, Bobby Glass. And they are going to basically start growing cannabis in the bottom of his mansion. Ray Winston is the head of this crime family and he's in prison though. And he's in a very fancy prison because he has his own kind of private grounds. And in season two, he's in the sauna for most of it. So he's half naked for a lot of it. And season two now sees Theo James's character, Eddie, wanting kind of a bigger pile of the drug business. And there's an Italian dimension. They start getting involved with some new people in Italy who are going to expand the empire. And season two is just as entertaining as season one. We also have Vinnie Jones in this, who plays the kind of gamekeeper and general fixer to Eddie's family. Incredibly loyal guy who gets a lot of stuff done for them. And in season two, his character, Jeff, expands a bit. Now, also in season two and in season one is Giancarlo Esposito. Now, you may not know the name, but by God, you do know who he is because he plays Gus Fring in Breaking Bad, the scary chicken man who's also a serious drug dealer. He plays Stanley Johnson in this, a wine-loving billionaire who's kind of interested in buying the mansion that Eddie lives in and gets involved. And he's back in season two in various guises. So I got to talk to Giancarlo Esposito, who plays Stanley Johnson in The Gentleman. Vinnie Jones, who you may know was a footballer and is now an actor and has been in lots of Guy Ritchie stuff. And the great Ray Winston, who needs no introduction. And I spoke to them earlier in the week about their roles in The Gentleman 2 on Netflix. Three legends on the screen. It's more than I can handle. Ray,
a legend and two legends.
Yeah.
Working
excellent.
Out.
Excellent. Ray, I wonder, is it strange, you know, for a lot of season two, you're in a robe, your office is a sauna, you're kind of half naked. You know, normally an actor goes to work and puts a shirt on. And I don't mean it as flimsily as it sounds, but is it weird to be not dressed like that for most of this? Like, does it do anything weird to your head?
You know, it takes away a lot of aggravation, I've got to be honest with you. But they must have spent a lot of money on the budget for my costume in the first series and thought they couldn't afford it this time. But I don't know, it's something quite freeing about that. You know, not being all done up in the gear, you know, and having a nice cravat on and a jacket on and all that kind of stuff, just to be sitting there and be powerful, you know?
Yeah.
The great thing as well is a sort of a vulnerability about being naked, in a way. You know, it's when you're at your most vulnerable, I guess, you know? And, you know, he's having some problems, it seems, in this series, you know, with some things, whether it's in his mind or whether it's actually there. So I think it works. I haven't seen it yet, but I think it probably works very well, you know?
I've seen it and it does work well. Vinny, you know, Ray mentioned vulnerability and your character, Jeff, in this one, I'm thinking you were probably pleased when you got the script because he goes places and there's a vulnerability to your character in this. And often, as you know better than I do, you're the hard man and all, but there's more nuance to him in season two, I would suggest. But you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, we've been working on this, myself and Guy, and he wants me to take more roles, and I'll be honest, and on my heart, I've been offered a couple of roles where it's the same old stuff that I've done for years, and we've said no. And you know, I just think when you got a big family, the boys will know, you got a big family and you got houses and everything else and kids in private school and all this bit, you have to go to work, and you don't make the best decisions, I don't think. And so I've had quite a lot of that. So now we're in a position with Guy, who's sort of mentoring me through it, that we're going to do these kind of roles, more stoic roles. I mean, me and Ray are getting no you know, no younger. So all them, we got to change.
None of us are, but
you know what I mean. So you know, you got to be smart enough to go with the times. You know, and I always say, two people that have always changed in, you know, in my life is like Elton John and Madonna. They've always changed it, and they've always gone with the flow. You know, and they're still there after all these years. And I think that's what we got to do. You know,
I don't think you'll have the problem after this, because they can see that other side of you.
Yeah.
And that is to do with the parts that you're offered and the parts that you play and the way you play them. So,
and you've got to say no. It's very hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But sometimes it's the best thing to do. Yeah. You know, if you don't fancy.
We have a chat now. I ring him. If I get an offer, I'll ring him. My manager goes mad, but I ring him and I go, "What do you think?" And he goes, "Yeah, shouldn't be a problem." Or I had one the other week and he went, "Disaster! So I said, I decline. So
you're taking career advice from Guy Ritchie now?
Yeah, well, I have done all my life, really. We had a little spell where I sort of went off hot-headed for a while, you know, in my drinking days, where I sort of thought I knew better than anyone else, as we do. And as Ray said a little while ago, I watched an interview with Ray, and you said something very poignant. We were young men then. And we make mistakes.
We all
make mistakes when we're young men. When you get older, I don't think there's too many excuses.
We ain't got the energy.
No, and the excuses get a bit thinner when you're young men and you're boozing and all that. You make anyway. Yeah. We've kind of crossed bridges now and everything else. But I absolutely talk to Guy all the time about the role.
Let me bring Giancarlo in, because he's been waiting because of these two articulate men. Giancarlo, the first scene in this, you're giving this speech, and it's very, you know, it's like Shadows and Nietzsche talking about incomplete men and God gone missing and stuff like that. And I know in the first season, there was times when, you know, the script was torn up in essence, and you went from scratch having already learned a whole scene. I'm wondering, that first scene, was that all scripted, or did Guy encourage some ad-libbing on that one? Because it's a great speech you give Theo's character.
Well, thank you. It's always interesting. I always come and try to learn it all and have it all in my head word for word, knowing that Guy will come and hear it on the day. He's already been in his trailer, he's already looked at it, and he'll say, I think we missed something, or we're going to throw it all out, or we're going to change it. So that speech was amended and adjusted. I always feel like I have to stay on my toes and be ready to improvise in a bit according to what our discussion is about that scene prior to doing it. And he's very open, because, you know, I'll stand there, as he often does, and think about it, and then come up with an idea that needs to go in, but it's, where is it placed? How do you place it? So then you have to find the rhythm to be able to say it, lips, tongue, and teeth, to have it flow. But this is the one thing, and it's the reason I'm here, is because I think Guy is really quite an intellectual. And I think my character obviously plays an Anglophile who knows so much, but he's trying to say, I'm also a spiritual being, a meditator. I'm also sober. And so I've come to a new place in my life. So I'm thoughtful. And I think Guy is very, very thoughtful about how to be able to place the nuggets in this show, in my character, that allow you to think a little deeper, that allow you to think about where you come from, where you're going, where you've been, and what you really want. Yeah. And so to say it in a poetic way through, and to represent history and what has happened before and gone before, allows you to know where you're going. So that speech was amended, and I really love doing it. But I love more than ever anything talking to him about the things I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? And it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, terrific. Ray, Bobby's in prison. Even though it doesn't look like it, but he is. He's a guest of the government, as they might say in The Sopranos. The first thing I ever saw you in, and I was far too young to have seen it, I was probably about 14, and it scared the SH1T out of me, was Scum, which happened to be your... And for people who haven't seen it, it's... Oh, my God, it's
one of my favourite movies, that.
It's petrifying. But I was thinking, I wonder... we might have to edit that. But I was wondering, over the years, Ray, were you asked to go into prisons a lot as a result of that film? Because it seems to me, because it was banned and stuff. Yeah,
back in the day, at the time when I was making the film, I didn't understand and I didn't realise what the implications of making it was. I was a kid, you know, and I was just happy to make the film, I suppose. But from that, you know, I went to Portland Bill, I've been to the Scrubs, I've done all that, and then talked with Borstal kids, you know, kids that were in there. You know, some of them murderers, you know. and you hear the stories, and you hear their point of view about what happened, and the way that we treat our kids, you know, and our other kids treat kids, and our men treat kids within the system, you know. And, you know, that kind of film, when I look back in it, you know, is if it helped one person, it done its job.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not going to, we've got problems with the prison system to this day, you know.
Sure,
we
yeah.
People out willy-nilly now because they ain't got enough room, you know.
I think it was as well.
So at the time, it was kind of, you know.
Well, he was standing up against the bullies, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Carling was against the bullies.
It was about against the system, really. It was about the system. You know, at the time, there was two films made by the BBC. One was Law and Order, which got shown, and Scum got banned.
Yeah.
They couldn't show both. It was almost like the government having the BBC and the government were hand in hand, you know, so they had to take one off. That's why we were able to make the film, because thank God for Mary Whitehouse, God bless her. You know, that's the only reason I'm sitting here today, because
yeah.
I made the film again and it went out. Then I probably wouldn't be an actor to this day, you know. So, you know, it's there's fine margins in life, that things you take a path, you know, and you don't choose that path. It just kind of pushes you that way, you know. So I've got a lot to be thankful for that film, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen,
obviously.
Yeah, of course. We're out of time. Sorry I didn't get to more questions, guys, but the season two is great. So continued success to the three of you. Thanks a
thank
lot.
You, thank you. Much.
Ray Winston, Vinnie Jones, and Giancarlo Esposito there talking to me about, well, The Gentleman too, but also you heard Ray there talking about Scum, a very frightening movie, which, as you heard there, changed his life. And you heard Vinnie Jones and Giancarlo Esposito there. Season two of The Gentleman is now on Netflix. If you like season one, you'll really like season two as well. Very entertaining Guy Ritchie stuff. After the break, the great Hugh Jackman on his new movie, The Death of Robin Hood. Yeah, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, have a little flavour of this.
I've seen the power in stories. They can be used to make men do terrible things. And then those terrible things become stories. And stories. Cannot trust any of them. We cannot be trusted with them.
Knives cut bread as well as they do flesh. It's a question of balance.
Does balance have a say?
I think if balance did not have some say, we would not be here.
Yes, Hugh Jackman there, opposite Jodie Comer, having quite a philosophical conversation about the stories we tell and balance in the universe. That is a clip from the new film, The Death of Robin Hood. We have Hugh Jackman playing Robin Hood, but it is not the Robin Hood that we are used to. This is a Robin who is tormented by his past killings and is living as an outlaw in kind of self-imposed exile, reflecting on just what a horrid life he's lived, which has involved pillaging and killing people, and he seems to spend his days defending himself against kind of the siblings and the children of people he's killed. And he's involved kind of in a fight in the first half of this movie, and he's wounded very badly, and he's then taken to this island called the Priory, where it's kind of a refuge place, and Jodie Comer plays the prioress of this island, who attempts to, I suppose, heal him in both senses of the phrase, physically and emotionally. And he befriends her, and also an orphan girl who may have some relevance to his past, let's just say. This is a pleasingly dark tale, and as I say, very different to the Robin Hood you might expect. So don't go into this expecting, you know, the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves things. It is not that. It is very violent in the first act, incredibly so at times. And then it turns into this powerful meditation on, I suppose, the cycle of violence and stuff we do in the past and how we can maybe never get away from some of those things. Hugh Jackman's role, he is brilliant. He is full of regret, and it's a dark, brooding performance. Jodie Comer is terrific as well. It was largely filmed in Northern Ireland. It's directed and written by Michael Sarnowski. He's a film director who gave us a brilliant movie called Pig and also A Quiet Place Day One. Both great, terrific movies. So he wrote and directed this. So I went to London earlier in the week and sat down with Hugh Jackman and the aforementioned Michael Sarnowski to talk about the death of Robin Hood and a bit more besides. Hello, how are you?
Fantastic.
We're great. Thanks,
nice
John.
To see you both. The film is terrific. And Hugh, I'm sure I'm not the first person to make this point, but you know, Kevin Costner, Mel Brooks, this is the opposite of the Robin Hood we've seen. Was that the appeal for you, I'm thinking, the idea of kind of usurping or deconstructing such a famous story and really turning it on its head?
It was a big part of what interested me about the script. I think the way then Michael sort of wove in the original or the more better known version of the mythology towards the end in such an inventive and beautiful and tender way just moved me. I cried as I was reading it.
Wow.
But I was really intrigued that it's not just this is a different retelling. It's more about, oh, let's look at the power of story. Let's look at what role does mythology play? How is it used? Why do we as humans have these stories that go over centuries, what is it? And that deconstructing of that really interested me.
Yeah, someone said don't mention deconstruction in interviews. It's very pretentious, but I did. There you go. Michael, I was surprised by how violent it was.
Yeah.
And I wasn't offended or anything, but like, you're not making a video nasty or whatever. So like, why did you have it so graphic? What was the point you were trying to make?
I mean, I think because so much of the second half of the movie is about the weight of that violence and grappling with that and that legacy, I didn't want to be cutesy about the violence in the first chunk. Like, it had to be, oh, this is unpleasant and brutal and real. And also, I think when you strip away the sort of like moral clarity of like, oh, this is good guys, like, you can show any violence you want as long as it's a good guy killing a bad guy. But when you start being like, wait a minute, who am I rooting for this? What, like, I think we've formed a really comfortable relationship with violence in movies, like maybe too comfortable, because we can sort of get behind like, oh, it's okay to chop off someone's head as long as they're a bad guy.
Yeah.
And like, I think sort of taking that comfort away and then leaning into like, oh, like, let's really feel this and believe that these are real human beings doing this to each other was kind of necessary so that it could weigh on the rest of the movie.
Yeah. I'm sorry to Irish it up, but I get to this time because it was filmed on the island of Ireland. You famously were doing lots of touring around. I saw the pictures. Like, what else are you going to say sitting in front of me? But what was it like to film in Ireland? And you can both answer that.
It was a dream. I'd always wanted to go to Ireland and spend an extended amount of time there. So as soon as I knew we were shooting in Ireland, which was Mike's choice, I was just thrilled. It was incredible. The crew were incredible. We were shooting on location, so we would just stay wherever close to the set and just sort of hang out. And I just loved every second of it, and I can't wait to go back. Everywhere I was like, I want to live there. I want to live here.
It's beautiful and like compact. Like everything we shot was about within an hour of Belfast. And you know, you get these Bleakmourne Mountains, this gorgeous North Coast, these old castles and churches and beautiful forests. And like, it was all accessible. And I don't think we could have, like, we scouted other places. We scouted the Highlands of Scotland. We scouted Lake District. Like, but none of these spots had everything we needed within this little footprint, which, you know, for an indie movie that shot in 30 days, we kind of needed that. And then on top of that, these crews, they kind of came up on like Game of Thrones, and this is their bread and butter, and they just know how to do this, and they know how to, in February, lug stuff up a mountain while it's pouring rain and like have a smile on their face the whole time. Like, it was lovely. I lived there for a year. We edited it in just outside of Belfast as well.
Okay.
And it was like one of the best years of my life. I loved it.
Well, it's nice to hear people not complain about the weather, you know? Hugh, your performance is brilliant in it. And, you know, you're this, like, I don't know, Richard Harris line in Winter or something. It's just, and you're so full of regret about the life you've lived. And I don't mean to Barbara Walters it all, but have you a lot of regrets in your working life or otherwise? I just was thinking, God, he's really tapping into, you know, I've only met you and I don't want to, as I say, go too deep, but it seemed that you could find the regret easy. But I guess that's acting.
I have regret, for sure. A lot, no. But, of course. And I think I'm always fascinated by why I instinctively say yes to. It's very much an instinct, and I often don't know until I get there what the reason for that instinct is. But it was clear from the beginning that this was a right role at the right time for me, and working with the right people, and everything actually felt very open and free, and I just sort of trusted it, and I'm really proud of it. The movie, yeah,
rightly so. Michael, is it important that I went to see this in a theater, as people call them? We call them cinemas. Is it important that people see it there?
It's pretty important to me. I mean, we shot this on 35 millimeter. We shot it on location. Like, it has a scope and a scale and a presence that I think is really beautiful. And we also, worked really hard on the score, the sound design. Like, there's a sense of just like, I want people to kind of lose themselves to this movie, because it's not a traditional movie. Like, it's very challenging. It's very violent and then very meditative and quiet. And like, I think it's a movie that you kind of need to like sit down and just sort of let wash over you.
Absolutely. Hugh, finally, I have three children, and two of them wanted me to ask you about previous films. One of them I better not, because you're tired answering that. But The Greatest Showman. Have you been, this wasn't my daughter's idea. She loves the film, but she didn't think of this question. But it seems to me that of all the, what would you say, sleeper hits or unexpected hits one might have, that one, the life that has had, like, it has shocked the rest of us. Has it, and I'm not saying it's not deserving of it, but was it surprising to you how far it's gone?
Completely. Yeah. It has shocked me. We were the second worst opening in Hollywood history.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever done a movie where I wasn't getting commiserating emails. I was getting no emails.
It was they're like, the worst.
People don't know what to say. It was crickets. So it kind of was incredible. And to see how the life of it's gone on, I had a call on the way here today. Someone rang me, a mate of mine owns a sports team, and he goes, we want to use that as our, at the stadium, at the beginning song. I'm like, It just keeps going, and I have no say in it, but
it feels like such a legendary movie now. Was it just like one of those slow burn, people kind of caught up to it gradually?
No, it took just 23 years between that and the previous all original musical, and Hollywood was terrified of it for that reason. It's like, you can't just go to the market with a musical they don't know, with songs they don't know, and expect people just to dig it. So I think everyone was like, so it just took a while for people to catch on, and they're still here in London. You can go and see a sing-along once a week here in Covent Garden, and it's been thrilling.
That's amazing.
I'm going to brag now, but I sort of feel I've had another one in The Sheep Detectives. I think that came out recently, and a lot of people have stopped me on that, which is cool.
My kids like that one too.
Yeah.
Well, maybe The Death of Robin Hood will be the hat trick, of sleeper hits. Lovely to meet you both. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, cheers,
guys.
All the best.
Thanks a lot. Hugh Jackman there, discussing the sleeper hits of Sheep Detectives and The Greatest Showman. And of course, we were talking about The Death of Robin Hood, which is now in cinemas, and it's a great watch. I was also talking to its director and writer, Michael Sarnowski. I did think Hugh Jackman was probably slightly taken aback when I asked him about regret in his own life. He probably wasn't expecting that, but it just occurred to me. He did regret so well in it. And we all have regrets. Rion Regret and all that. So that was The Death of Robin Hood, and it is in cinemas, as I say. After the break, something very different. An Irish documentary called Celtic Utopia. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. Now, finally, after those big movies and TV releases, I wanted to turn to something Irish, something called Celtic Utopia. It's a new Irish documentary arriving in cinemas after a very acclaimed run at international festivals. And it's a vibrant, thought-provoking exploration of contemporary Irish music, particularly folk, I think it's fair to say, and how that's tied up with identity, culture, featuring such artists as the Mary Wallopers, Lancome, Poor Creature, Jinx Lennon, and many more. It was filmed over 4 years, and the film combines live performances, candid conversation, and archive footage to examine how a new generation of musicians is drawing on Ireland's rich musical past while embracing influences from punk, hip-hop, and experimental music. And some of the guests are interviewed in some of the most strange places. Along the way, it also asks powerful questions about history, colonial legacy, and what it means to be a modern Irish person. It was co-directed by Dennis Harvey, and I'm delighted to say Dennis joins me on the line now. Dennis, hi, how are you?
How are you doing, John? Thanks a million for having me.
So I said to you before we came on, this is a strange film. And I mean that as a compliment. This was kind of billed to me as a documentary about the kind of modern Irish folk contemporary music scene with people like the Mary Wallopers and stuff like that. But instead we have this movie that's kind of a, you know, it's an angry look at maybe how folk musicians feel about the state of Ireland in lots of ways. Is that a correct assessment of it? You tell me.
Yeah. No, I'm really happy to hear that you think it's strange. And I think before you said wonderful. And so that's all really good.
I did say wonderful before we came on air. I didn't want to over-egg it on air, you know, but let's call it wonderful. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. But so, yeah, no, the film is really like inspired and influenced in many ways by two films. Rocky Road to Dublin by Peter Lennon, which came out in 1967, if I'm not mistaken, and then The Road to God Knows Where by Alan Gilsonan, which came out in 1988. And they're both films that sort of look, they sort of take the temperature of Ireland at a particular time. And they're both sort of angry films and angry and strange films, yeah, in different ways. And that was something from the start that me and my co-director Lars were interested in doing, like that, not trying to make a sort of just like praising the nice things about Ireland, that it's way more complex. It's a way more complex place to be young and to be an artist, and as well as to be anyone. There's a lot of issues in Ireland, but there's a lot of real amazing, beautiful things as well. But that to have a single track sort of praising the music and the musicians, that was never really what we planned to do. And I think the musicians were refreshed and happy to have a different sort of perspective as well.
Yeah, they certainly were. And there's, you know, moments with the Mary Wallopers, and they're really going hard on what at times a horrible place they think Ireland certainly has been in the past. We have the lead singer bemoaning the fact that there's, in essence, a petrol station named after Barack Obama. Like, these musicians are angry about, you know, not just modern Ireland, but what's happened in the past, be it Magdalen Laundries.
Yeah, so, I mean, and this is something that was, I think it became clearer to me when, like, I moved away from Ireland. I'm back a lot filming stuff and screening stuff, but when I, like, I've been living in Sweden for the last 9 years, and something I think about often is that over here, it's not really normal to have, like, every couple of months on the radio to have loads and loads of new victims of, you know, of like institutional abuse or child sexual abuse speaking up. And like in Ireland, that sort of seems to be that's happening constantly over the last decade or so. And people, we should be angry about this. That's how did this happen? And why did it take so long for so many people to get to be able to speak up? And it's so, they're so brave for doing it. And so I think the Mary Wallopers are a band who, yeah, they have a personal sort of relationship with this. They don't know this. They've never met their sister. She was taken away from their parents before they were born, and they've never met her. They still don't know where she is. And, you know, of course you should be really pissed off about that, because it's insane. But then at the same time, this sounds like it's all heavy and dark. But I think the nice thing about Ireland is that people often carry this trauma and these issues quite lightly. You know, that you can go from being angry to being really funny in the same sentence.
It's how we've survived.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, exactly. That sort of humor is how we've survived. And then as well, the music, I think, isn't it? Like, the music, a lot of the music, the folk music and traditional music can sort of carry these sort of dual realities at the same time, which is something beautiful.
Now, the way you interview all these guests is fascinating, and there is heavy themes in it, but it is also, I would say, first and foremost, a celebration of contemporary Irish music, be it folk or hip hop. But it's fantastic. You have like the Mary Wallopers in like a abandoned house / pub, sometimes looks like a recording studio. You have people on O'Connell Bridge playing, people sitting in piers near the sea off the coast of Donegal, someone jumping into the Liffey behind a musician playing on O'Connell Bridge. Yeah. There's all sorts going on. So I guess you were keen to situate the music and, you know, not just the guy sitting on a piano staring into space moodily.
Yeah, we always wanted to be out among the people and out in sort of living spaces. And we also, yeah, like from the start, we worked with two brilliant cinematographers, Tuva Björk and Jamie Goldrick. And that was like, we wanted to have two cameras so that we could capture. We knew there'd be interruptions and things like that if we were out on the streets playing music and talking to people. And so we wanted to have two cameras to always capture that. And but it was crazy that, like you mentioned, the guy jumping into the Liffey behind Sean Fitzgerald playing, like, that was literally the first take on the first day of shooting of the 4-year shoot. And I had sort of brought this, most of the crew over from Sweden, and I was like, oh, it'll probably be pretty crazy. There'll probably be a lot of stuff going on. But I really didn't expect, like, instantly that someone would throw themselves into the Liffey. And the guy seemed to be a really good swimmer. He was quite drunk, I think, but he was also a good swimmer. He did these sort of, like, acrobatic dives, backward dives and things like that.
Yeah, being drunk and swimming can go hand in hand, although we do not recommend it.
No.
Let me ask you this. You do go north, and I suppose, I'm not sure if it's a criticism, but I suppose someone looking at this could say it's quite pro the nationalist side in terms of, you know, the experience up there. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, so we, like, yeah, I want United Ireland, and I think all of us in the film do, like, none of us want a partitioned island. But we were also very, very keen to not have a single track, just a sort of like pamphlet, political pamphlet. And that's why we reached out to Young Spencer, who is a guy from the Shankill Road, a rapper from the Shankill Road. And it took a long time to sort of get contact, but when we finally met, he's one of the most amazing, like, articulate, kind people I've ever met. And he's really, really, like, he comes from we come from completely different traditions and
so he's a unionist Protestant, I guess, is how we describe.
Yeah, well, a loyalist more. Yeah, he's from working, you know, like, from the Shankill Road, which is, yeah, it's very, it is an area with, like, a lot of socioeconomic issues. But he, just like Kneecap, like, you know, from who are from the other side of the wall, from the Falls Road, they both understand that they have way more in common with each other than they do with some of the politicians in Stormont who are just dividing their communities. And that's, and Young Spencer, since we filmed with him in the film, he supported Kneecap twice, most recently at Fela, in Belfast on the Falls Road. Like, so I think it was really refreshing for me, and all of us to meet someone from that side of the divide, you know, when we become from a different perspective and actually understand that there's a real desire just to find a way to live together, which is a process, of course, that has been going on for ages and since the Good Friday Agreement. But it feels, I think, like Young Spencer and people like Kneecap, that this sort of young generation have a real refreshing approach to this, you know, and it felt really important for us. If you're ultimately looking for United Ireland, the worst thing that could happen would be that, like, the new minority community, which would be loyalists and unionists, would be treated the way the Catholics were in the 60s and 70s and things like that in the north.
Yeah.
You know, we have to do better this time. And so that's why it felt, in a film like this, we had to have someone like Young Spencer,
yeah, he's a fascinating guy. Are just about everyone you talk to, including Jinx Lennon, who people may know of old, who looks remarkably well because he's been around a long time. No disrespect to Jinx Lennon, but he hasn't appeared to age since the last time I saw him about 10 years ago, which is some feat. It must be that border air. Tell me this. We're talking about Celtic Utopia. It's getting a select cinema release this Friday. It's going gangbusters at festivals, I gather, Dennis. What kind of reaction are you getting?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I'm just back from Tokyo. It had a theatrical release around Japan.
Wow.
Coming out in 30 cities there, and it was amazing.
Cinemas.
Yeah. Wow. It was. I was surprised as you are, but
I salute it, but I'm surprised. But yeah, tell me, how's it gone over in Japan?
It was amazing. The response, it was like really, really busy cinemas, you know, three times a day when I was over there doing the screenings and the talks. And people with like lots of knowledge about Irish music, and then also people with no knowledge of Ireland or Irish music who were just curious. And I mean, there's a real, I think a lot of people, it's been this way around the world at screenings, like, I think a lot of people didn't know the history that we're telling in the film. Mm-hmm. You know, we do try to take a refreshed look or an alternative perspective on some of the issues that the country has had. And maybe sometimes these things aren't the ones that are brought up in, you know, Irish culture abroad settings. So that's been a real nice, it's felt sort of that we've been validated a bit with trying to take a fresh look at Irish history and try to understand the sort of, yeah, the institutional trauma and but also the resilience and the strength of people who've come through that. So it has, and I think just people laugh a lot as well, you know. Yeah. It's
there
very
are,
funny.
There are very, funny. Yeah, very funny moments in it. And of course, the music, it's no surprise, it's absolutely wonderful. It is in cinemas, as I say, from the 4th of September. It's getting a select cinema release, and hopefully it goes far and wide. It was co-directed by Dennis Harvey. Dennis, the best of luck with it.
Thanks a million, John. Cheers. Lovely to talk to you.
This country is so new, and I don't think people realize how new we are. Like, we're still trying to navigate our way, like, past British colonialism. And it's hard.
What do they say, like, this? The winners write the history, the losers write the songs kind of thing?
When you're from where we're from, religion is just, you're entrenched in it. You're just, you grow up, and if, you know, I mean, the curbs are either red, white, blue, or green, white, and orange.
But to us, folk is offensive. It's supposed to frighten people.
It's like, it's meant, rotten songs. The songs were always meant to scare priests and politicians. Yeah. They weren't meant to sell citrons, you know. Wait.
A clip there from Celtic Utopia. And before that, Dennis Harvey there, the co-director of the strange and wonderful new documentary, Celtic Utopia, which is in select cinemas from this weekend, from this Friday, the 4th of September. If you want to get in touch with me about anything we've been talking about on the show or anything you've been watching, you can email us, screentime@newstalk.com. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Saoirse Ronan, yes, about her new movie, Bad Apples, where she plays a teacher in a pretty tricky situation. That's all to come next week. You can listen back to this or any of the other previous episodes of Screen Time on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Get out there and go and see something in the cinema. It's National Cinema Weekend. It's ongoing for the weekend. Tickets are starting at €4. Leave you with a little music from the movies. We were talking about Irish folk. A band who don't feature in Celtic Utopia, but easily could have, I guess, are Ye Vagabonds. And this is one of the best Irish folk songs I've heard in years, used to beautiful effect in the movie King Frankie from a few years ago. So I will leave you with the glorious Blue is the Eye and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
A crack in the sky lends a light to the dark. The wind blows the ember cold from the heart. You carry it proudly through ditches and trees and cross the horizon to lie down and sleep. Lie down and sleep, sleep well, my darling. Blue is the eye, watches over the sea. Lie down and sleep, sleep well, my darling. Blue is the eye that looks after thee.